You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. A world dismissed as conspiracy by those who want to keep its secrets hidden, exposing the dangers, denials, and deceptions. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.
And ladies and gentlemen of the jury, the prosecution is not going to get that man today. No. Because I'm gonna get him!
And welcome to this episode of the Hagman and Hagman Report. We're coming to you live from our radio and television studios here in beautiful Northwest Pennsylvania, where we broadcast live each and every weeknight. That's Monday through Friday, 7 to 10 p.m. Eastern Time, right here on the Global Star Radio Network. This is the place to be. Russ Dizdar's on. Ted Brewer, of course. My goodness, Dave Hodges. All the great shows right here on the Global Star Radio Network. Folks, we're also simulcast, if I can talk, on BTR, Blog Talk Radio. You can watch us live in my archive, of course, at our official YouTube channel. Just go to HagmanandHagman.com. And that's our home base on the internet, HagmanandHagman.com. I want to welcome you in. Come on in. Come on. Welcome you into our new look here as we sit, in our newly refurbished, what's that word?
Renovated. Newly renovated studios. Yeah. We got a brand new desk.
Yeah. The handmade.
And
you should have seen them quarrying the rock.
Yeah. No, we got a lot. We made a lot of changes here.
Yeah. In fact,
we did. And this beautiful desk is thanks in part to Eric, our tech.
Well, not thanks in part. Thanks to.
Yeah. Yeah, without him, this would be a pile of rubble.
Well, yeah, Eric's not moving too well today. But folks, for those new to the program, and I know we have some new viewers and listeners tonight in the viewer challenge, because if you're just listening, you can't see what we're talking about. Just go check it out on our YouTube channel. But of course, you know I'm Doug Hagman. I'm at the helm with fellow investigative researcher, and of course, my son Joe Hagman. Together, something like I like to call the America's premier father and son investigative team, if I can talk correctly. We are so excited to bring you a very special program tonight. I hope by now everyone has told their family, their friends, to listen, to watch, because tonight I believe we've got one of the most important shows we've had ever. And I'll tell you why. 20 years ago, and I remember this vividly, 20 years ago this next month, on July 17th, we lost 230 people. TWA Flight 800 fell out of the sky, or actually was blown out of the sky, just off the southern coast of Long Island. And again, 230 people. Now think about that. Men, women, children. All right. And, of course, we were led to believe by the people in charge that the cause was a center fuel tank explosion caused by, well, we can get into this with our guests, but...
Yeah, we will get into
that. Yeah. But you know what? I remember that night, and I remember thinking, how could this happen? And then it was sometime thereafter. In fact, we were... or I was doing investigations in New York State, partially in New York City, and that was like before and after 9/11. And I remember after 9/11 thinking, oh my goodness, you know, thinking back to 1996 and thinking back to this
was my dad's 9/11. You know,
it was.
Many people focus on 9/11 and state it as their, you know, beginning point of where they began to look into alternative theories and alternative narratives as to what happened versus what history says. Well, my father's been looking into TWA Flight 800 since the day it happened.
Yeah, you know,
I remember clearly listening to episodes of Coast to Coast.
Yep.
And you know, many other things that we would do in our spare time while doing investigations about TWA Flight 800.
That's right. Traveling from place to place. And I remember traveling along or on Long Island and seeing this the sign for East Mauritius and thinking, you know, here it is, here we are. And of course, I had to stop. I don't think you were with me. But I had found the work of author Jack Cashel and followed him since he had written his first words about TWA Flight 800. And now today, we are so honored to have him in studio, author, investigative researcher, journalist, Mr. Jack Cashel. Jack, thanks for coming and being really our inaugural guest in our studio, man.
Hey, Doug, Joe, thanks for having me. And I, you know, for the record, I'm about 45 minutes up the road from you, where I spend much of my summer in, just over the New York State line. And when my friend Nin told me about you, I said, well, we got to get down here and talk to these guys. So,
oh, man.
Here we are.
Well, you know what, folks? The reason Jack is with us tonight is he has written a new book. It's going to be released on July 5th. It's still July 5th, right?
July 5th, yeah.
All right.
2 weeks.
2 weeks from now. And I had the privilege and honor to read an advanced copy of it. And here is the, well, here it is,
right here.
There it is, right there. TWA 800, the crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy. We're going to be talking about all three tonight. And I've got a lot of questions about this. Now, you might say, well, what's the relevance? It was 20 years ago. The relevance to me couldn't be stronger today, because right now, what do we have? We've got the Clinton apparatus. In my view, the same apparatus, political machinery that was in charge back in the 1996 when this happened is attempting to get back into
power
charge
now,
in Washington now. But and still, even more importantly, there were 230 people that perished from this incident. So, and have we been told the truth? I don't think so. So after reading this book, the advance read of this book, folks, I don't make any money. We don't make any money by selling or, you know, promoting books. But I will tell you this. This is one of the most convincing books I've read with respect to the, I don't even want to say the alternative theories, but the fact that there's not only something wrong, I think Mr. Jack Cashel has uncovered exactly what's wrong, who the people are involved in the cover-up and why, and the conspiracy and why. And he does it with using the very documents from the government. I mean, no alternative sources. This is right from the investigator's mouth, the people's mouth. So anyway, I'm not going to take up too much more time here talking about Jack's book when he's with us. Jack, again, thank you for coming. And also, you authored a book in 1997, I think it was, First Strike?
No, it was 2003. I co-authored it with James Sanders. And
okay.
James was the fellow who got me an interest in this. And unlike yourself, I don't remember where I was when the plane went down. And given the fact that I, you know, grew up in New Jersey and spent part of my summer in Jersey, sure, I should have remembered. But what got me engaged was about 5 years after the crash, 4 or 5 years afterwards, 4 years actually, James Sanders was speaking in Kansas City. And I went to hear him speak, and it shocked me that there were so many people there, and they were so animated. And then it dawned on me that Kansas City is the historic home of TWA.
Right.
And most of the people there were former TWA, or current TWA people. And James told a story about how he and his wife Elizabeth, who was a TWA trainer and flight attendant, were both arrested and convicted of conspiracy for James' early efforts to get at the truth of this project. And And we went out to dinner afterwards, a bunch of people, and I ended up sitting at the end of the table speaking with Elizabeth, who is like this sweet, agelessly pretty Filipino-American. She had been an exotic dancer. You could see she's really a pretty woman. And she was innocent. Yeah. And that she could end up being, thrown into an orange jumpsuit and made to frog walk into a courthouse because she introduced her husband, who's an investigative reporter, to a manager, 747 manager and trainer, Terry Stacey. That's all she did.
Right, right.
And I'm listening to this. I said, maybe there's something here. And what happened is then, at the time I was working mostly in advertising, and mostly, then I segued into writing for journals and also into doing documentaries. And so I met with them for breakfast the next morning in Kansas City. They lived in Florida at the time. And I said, have you ever thought of doing a documentary on TWA Flight 800? Because it's such a visual subject. And they had not to that point. And we got to talking. And then I was still very skeptical. I have a natural skepticism about conspiracies and whatnot. I thought this was another one of those Clinton conspiracies, sure. Some of which are unfortunately true, but some of which aren't. And so they invited me down to their home in Florida to review their material. And I took them up on it. Before I went down there, I read two mainstream books on the crash. And I'm thinking, how can you possibly get away with a conspiracy this large? And the books were both orthodox rehashings of the government position. They had me all but convinced. Then I go down to Florida, meet with the Sanders, and then I saw the one bit of evidence that I didn't even know existed. And that was the eyewitness reports. They had been suppressed for 4 years. And then finally, they'd just been released. There were, we had been led to believe there were a handful of eyewitnesses that may or may not have seen something.
Mm-hmm.
The FBI interviewed more than 750 people.
That's right.
258 of them, by the account of the National Transportation Safety Board, had seen an object soaring up and exploding at or near TWA Flight 800. 56 of them had tracked that object all the way from the horizon to the airplane. And they're remarkably consistent, as even the authorities had to acknowledge. And every one of them says this. I was looking out, I was at fishing or surfing or flying or sitting in this is the affluent South Shore of Long Island where people are used to being taken seriously. And every account says something like this. And then someone said, look, and I see this object zigzagging out away from shore. And then it's got a red tip and a smoky contrail. And then it disappears, and then it explodes and explodes. And then I see this plane break apart, and then I see it fall out of the sky. You read that 700, or actually most people just saw the end, but 250 times where people see that ascending, exploding, breaking up. They're describing the breakup sequence of the aircraft before the FBI, the NTSB, were able to figure it out from the debris field. And you read that and say, where was this information? Why didn't the New York Times... You know how many of those 258 people, you know how many the New York Times interviewed? Zero.
Right.
Not a single one of them. And then you begin to think, maybe there's something here. And that led to this, what for me has now been a 15-year quest to get at the truth.
Well, New York Times, I mean, they controlled the story from day one.
Yes.
This whole thing, I mean, I remember when it happened. And for those who don't know or are unfamiliar with this, again, we're talking about July 17th, 1996, just a beautiful evening, calm evening. Think of 9/11, the morning of 9/11, how serene and calm it is. But here it is, Wednesday, July 17th, 1996, 8:19, a Boeing 747-100 takes off from JFK Airport, headed for Rome via Paris. 12 miles out, roughly, there is an explosion in midair. And Jack, as you said, over 700 witnesses, 258 eyewitnesses who saw a vertical streak, and 56 specifically who saw a vertical streak from the horizon from the Atlantic Ocean area. Those are my words, though. Yet we, after one of the most expensive and extensive investigations in aircraft history, in the history, I think, of anything, We were told that, of course, it was a center fuel tank breach that caused the death of 230 people aboard, 212 passengers and 18 crew. Now, the explosion took place at 13,760 feet, just for those people who are reportedly, okay. Now, some sources, if you look on the internet, you're gonna find all sorts of different sources, but that's, the altitude is, at least in the reports I saw, Jack, officially listed at 13,760.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. During this time, on July 17th, 1996, Bill Clinton was in office. Hillary Clinton was the deputy president, I suppose. July 17th was Saddam Day, right? Or
a National Liberation Day.
National Liberation Day for
Saddam's Iraq, yeah.
Okay.
Their evil 4th of July, you know.
We were, what, a few days out from the Atlanta Olympics?
2 days before the start of the Atlanta Olympics.
Okay. And what else is going on? Oh, in the wake of the Khobar
Towers, right, had blown up 3 weeks earlier. This is the military, the Navy, reportedly, and I have no reason to disbelieve this because my sources are, you know, the mainstream sources, was on the highest state of alert since the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Right.
They were looking for something, and they were, you know, and this is part of the story we'll get into. What they did that evening is at the heart of our story.
Okay. All right. But I mean, that kind of lays a foundation. And here we have, again, the Clinton political apparatus in office. And I look back at that time. I look back in July, at July 1996, and I'm thinking about the politics and geopolitics at the time. Against the backdrop of what we just described. So where do you want to start, Jack, in terms of where's a logical place to start? Because...
Well, let's start with the logic of the crash and the logic, right, of the cover-up, I should say. There's an interesting anecdote I have here. 3 years ago, an excellent documentary came out. You may have seen it. It's called TWA Flight 800 by Tom Stalkup and Christina Borgeson.
Right.
And I wasn't involved with it, but I know them both. Stalkup is a physicist who's been working on this from the beginning. Borgeson was a CBS producer who lost her job because she tried to get this on the air a little too aggressively back when it happened. It got a fair amount of positive attention. It shocked me. The New York Times even reviewed it, and it said their review was, and this is for a high praise for New York Times, not your ordinary crackpot conspiracy stuff. They persuaded six high-level whistleblowers who worked on the investigation to come forward on camera and talk about it. So I was invited on CNN's morning show to talk about it with Allison Day. Allison Kosick was her name. And it was one of those CBS morning shows. I don't know.
Right.
I don't watch them typically. And it was, no, CNN. I'm sorry, CNN's morning show. And so it was on pretty like a 5 or 6 minute segment. This is typically the way they do it. And they had on with me a fellow named Jim Polk, who Pulitzer Prize winning, you know, something or another, who produced a documentary for CNN. And, you know, he was there to, you know, refute what I saw. And he said, you know, there were, it was so dishonest. I'm going to skip the beginning. I'll get right to the punchline. There's about a minute left, and hadn't had much to say because this guy's talking. And Kosick says, okay, Jack, if it was a cover-up, you know how they talk,
yeah,
patronizing.
Sure.
Who shot it? Why did they shoot it? And why the cover-up? I said, yeah, Allison, I got about a minute here, so let's just get right to the cover-up. And I just said this spontaneously. I said, this was Bill Clinton's Benghazi moment. I said, he's on the verge of winning a re-election, and he has a national security disaster take place on his watch. And what he did is what Obama and Hillary did in 2012, as they just tried to kick that can down the road past November. You know, they knew they had a media that would go along with them. They just wanted to get past November, and then they'd worry about it. And then she said, oh, okay, Jack, thanks. You know,
And that was it.
Yeah. Well, here's the punchline. The next day, I look at the transcript. My answer's been edited out.
No.
Right? It's
they
gone.
They wouldn't do that.
No. They would. And then what's curious is that just last week, Newsday, which is the big Long Island newspaper, had a little editorial by their head editorial writer on my forthcoming book. They hadn't read the book. And they said, Jack Cashel, he's the guy who tried to compare TWA Flight 800 to Benghazi, you know, and then just dismissed it right out of. But that's the logic of it.
Man.
That is the underlying logic. You have Democrats in the White House who know that the media will give them a pass.
Sure.
And yet, this is the most successful cover-up in American peacetime history. That they got away with this. That they had the nerve to do it in front of thousands, literally, of Long Islanders, is really stunning. And they could only have gotten away with it with the complicit media.
You know, what really struck me, and this was unbelievable as far as I was concerned, reading in your book, and of course, folks, again, his book, TWA, The Crash, The Cover-Up, and The Conspiracy. And go to Amazon right now. I mean,
you do you have a copy permission. Around here?
It's right here.
Yeah.
It's right here.
Oh, yeah. I'll let you have another. Oh, the first book.
Yeah. No, the first. No, this is the book. Okay. So go to Amazon right now. You have permission to leave this program just briefly.
Just open a new tab.
Yeah. Right. Open a new tab. But pre-order this because what is in here is just an amazing look. As an investigator for 30 years, you can tell I don't do much well. I certainly am not a great talk show host, but I feel I'm a pretty good investigator. Have I investigated airline incidents? No, of course not.
No, blew right a fatty.
Yeah, well, yeah, but you know what? I know a good investigative work product when I see it, and this is definitely it. This is, as far as I'm concerned, the magnum opus of all books with respect to TWA Flight 800. It's by Jack Cashel. So please order the book, pre-order it, make it go to number one. And by doing so, you're sending a statement to the mainstream media. If we can have a rally cry right now with all of the listeners, all of the viewers, just a rally cry to tell the media, demand that Jack Cashel be invited on the talk shows, or just send this book to number one. That's going to get people's attention. That's going to change a whole lot because there's a whole lot to come out. But Jack, I was saying, you know, 258, to convince 258 people, basically, or to attempt to convince the world that 258 people and over didn't see what they saw, and over 700 people to cause them to question what they saw. I mean, it's I guess it's a brilliant tactic, but I mean,
I'd ask, could it be done today?
No, it couldn't be done today for a simple reason, the internet. And at that time, 1996, only about 10% of the people were online. So they didn't have the ability to communicate among themselves. So most people thought they were the only one. And then, you know, so they got gaslit by the FBI and the CIA, you know, that gaslight phenomenon where you convince people they're crazy based on that old Charles Boyer, Ingrid Bergman movie. But what's impressive is that the eyewitnesses are the one group of people not to buckle. They know what they saw. And these are serious people. Some of them are like military pilots, fishermen, people who know about, you know, relative bearing and what they know what they saw. And they have not been able to break the eyewitnesses. And finally, they are the difference between this story and any other story where there's an element of conspiracy involved. These are real people. And what I do in the book, Doug, and what I try to do, is I'm a writer. I mean, a lot of people who write investigative books aren't writers. They're investigators. And they focus on the wrong things. Not the wrong things, but things that are not convincing. This is a story, really, of people and politics. And I write it in the first person because I talk about my own journey from being skeptical of all conspiracies into someone who understands that this can happen in modern-day America.
Mm-hmm.
And what's curious, and since I've been talking about this in the last 2 weeks before the book comes out, and I've been getting contacted by every single day now by another pilot, another investigator at the crash site. Talked to one today. I'll tell you his story in a second. Yesterday I got a call from an FBI agent. You know, when they start breaking, you're really doing something. Last week I got a call from the air traffic controller who was on the screen. You know.
Hence the article in the American Thinker, right?
Yeah.
And
so, like today, for instance, the pilot, this is an anecdote, it's useful, and we'll get back to the main thread of the story, but I got an email from a fellow who had seen the American Thinker article, and he said, hey, you know, my cousin was on the investigation. You really ought to talk to him. And I said, if he wants to talk to me, here, I gave him my phone number. And I would say, by the way, anyone who wants to reach me, just jcashel@AOL.com, who has some inside information, jcashel@AOL.com. But so I'm talking to this guy. He worked for the Airline Pilots Association. He was their chairman of their airline safety committee. He arrived on the scene on day one, and he was part of the investigation. Within 10 days, he'd been thrown off the investigation. He said, I'd never seen anything like this. This was Gestapo tactics.
Finding too much truth?
Yeah. Because wow. What happened is he found a part along the right wing that had clearly been damaged from the outside, you know, from the basic, the pattern. And he brought it in to be tested. And they have this high-level Aegis testing system on site. And it passed, you know, positive, 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 positive. They did 7 tests on it. And then they said they sent it to Washington. It was never seen again. The part was never seen.
Nice.
And then every time he tried to question it, he was just being bullied. Then they decided that he needed psychological help, right? I mean, just right out of, you know, it was like 1984, you know?
Wow.
And then within 2 weeks, he was gone, right? And he was the chairman of the Airline Pilots Association Safety Committee. And he said, this is the way they rolled. And he said, there's, you know, I could, you know, there's 100 stories like this that are waiting to be told once people understand. Then now it's the time to tell them.
Well, Jack, let me ask this. The claim that there would have to be thousands upon thousands of people involved in the cover-up, is that true, or do you just need a few at the top? I mean,
and that's an excellent question, especially when we get into talking about the Navy.
Right.
But here's the analogy that I would give, is that when I was young and foolish, I went to see the Indianapolis 500. And we had been out all night drinking and in the infield. And I don't know if you've ever been, but it's a zoo. You know, they may have cleaned it up since then, but not then. So you're there the next morning. You're half, you know, conscious. And you're at the, you know, you're watching your quarter mile of a 2.5 mile track, right? Now, I could tell you virtually everything that went on in that quarter mile. But if someone said to me afterwards, something horrible happened at the Indianapolis 500. We want to talk to Jack Cashel, who is there, right? And all I could say, if it wasn't in my quarter mile, I don't know what happened. Well, this is what I've been finding out as I talk to people who were involved. They saw this much. They just saw a little bit. And they could tell you about their little bit, but they don't know the larger picture. This is true for not only for sailors, but for the investigators on Long Island, from FBI agents. So they contribute little bits. And in the book, you know, I tell [S2] Yeah. [S1] Their stories. People who loaded the missiles onto the sub, people who were had to scrub the command information center after something went awry. But they don't know the whole story, and it's very, very, very few people who do. And I'm trying to goad at least one of them to come forward, because that's what it'll take to really break this case.
So you've compartmentalized pieces of information that would lead to a clearer picture of actually what happened on this day. And you're working toward that goal, but right now, what you have are people who are reluctant to come forward.
Well, and I will say that I've been really impressed in the last 2 weeks how many people have come. I'm literally one a day, you know, two a day. Because finally, it's like, I think there's going to be a floodtide. And Doug, you're exactly right. This has to be pushed from the bottom up.
Yeah.
And that's why I was really thrilled to have the opportunity to come on this show. And it was really, you know, thanks to Nin, my friend here, who's a big fan and listener, said, you got to get down and talk to Doug and Joe. And it was, since we're only 45 minutes away, it was great. But, yeah, that's what it's going to take. And, but you're right, Joe. It was tightly compartmentalized for a reason. And as an example, and I talk about this in the book, there was a congressional hearing, I guess it was about, 2 years after the crash? And the people from the NTSB who investigate accidents and are predisposed to see accidents, they were, the one guy is testifying, goes, yeah, I think it was an accident. I have no reason to believe it was a bomb. And if the FBI says, if someone says it's a missile, I didn't see any evidence of a missile. He's testifying 2 years after the thing. He doesn't know there are any eyewitnesses. He did not know there were any eyewitnesses. That's how controlled it was. If you're reading the New York Times, which owned the story, they didn't interview any eyewitnesses who saw a missile. Not one single eyewitness, you know?
Well, since you were the one that talked to many eyewitnesses, and us being in investigators, we dealt with eyewitnesses a lot. How do you get the truth out of eyewitnesses when it seems that, you know, when 100 people see the same event, you'll have 100 different versions?
Well, in this case, you have... let me just add one wrinkle here, and this is, I think, which makes this book advances what our knowledge is so greatly. And that is that, and this happened only within the last year, for reasons I'm not sure of, either out of carelessness or out of indifference, responding to a Freedom of Information Act request, the CIA released this treasure trove of documentation. And it explained in step by step by step by step how the CIA corrupted this investigation. And unlike many accidents, you know, where different people see this or just different people see that, or like if we were at the Indianapolis 500 and I said, yeah, I tell you about my quarter mile, even the people who were trying to suppress it had to admit that the eyewitness testimony was, their quote, remarkably consistent. Mm. They saw the whole picture. They weren't like at a quarter mile of a track. They saw the whole sky, the best eyewitnesses. And you see this, Doug, I go through the 40 best eyewitnesses.
Oh, yeah.
And if you read their accounts, you cannot but believe they know what they saw, especially since some of them were military people or, you know, people who knew what they were seeing.
Yeah, you got a cross section. You got pilots. You got people in the military. You got people, you know, on the sea. People very familiar with that area. Indeed, I get that. What how can we best lay this out for people at this point?
Yeah, there's a lot of information in here. Going through some cliff notes that my dad put together and reading different parts of your book. There's a lot of information that I had no idea had anything to do with the TWA Flight 800. And just to give you an example, the red residue, the explosive residue inside the plane,
which
this is one of 100 things that I'm learning
right
as I'm going through your book. So I guess if you want, we can take it step by step.
Yeah,
from you know,
and walk us through.
I'll walk you through because and this is information now that your audience is getting. That even most researchers in TWA don't know if they haven't read the CIA documents.
Right.
And that's the CIA is like open the pages, open the book. It, you know, it's like it tells you finally how the sausage was made. We knew about the sausage at the end, but we got to see the sausage making. And the CIA, we learned from their own memoranda, was involved from day one. Now, think about this. I got to back you up a little bit. If you remember at the 2004 9/11 hearings, George Tenet, then the director of Central Intelligence, he was a Clinton guy, came up through the Democratic ranks. Bush held him over for God knows what reason. And he's talking to the 10 members on the 9/11 commission about, they said, why weren't we able to stop September 11? And he said, well, it was because of the wall. And he had to explain what the wall was. There was a wall placed between intelligence gatherers and prosecutors so that the FBI wasn't able to talk to the CIA. And the CIA, even when the FBI, the intelligence gatherers and the FBI, couldn't talk to the prosecutors. And that was the first time the public was aware of that wall.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a kicker to this I'll come back to later. But what we see in the CIA documents, there was no wall. They were collaborating with the FBI from day one. They weren't really collaborating, though, because the CIA had the upper hand in this relationship. And they had the upper hand because someone had their back, and they knew it. So 2 weeks into the crash, the FBI meets with the FBI missile team, meets with the CIA analyst, and he identifies himself as Philip Taus. He wins a medal for his work. And they tell him, and at this point, the FBI is doing a good faith job. They're really trying to do what they're trying to do. And he tells them, he says, the CIA guy reports to his boss, the names are redacted. He says, you know, we met with the FBI missile team. They tell us they have 144 excellent eyewitnesses, their words. Their testimony is remarkably consistent. too consistent to be anything but a surface-to-air missile strike on the airplane. And these are mainly professional people, and that's the dilemma they're facing, right? And he said that there is a very high probability this is a surface-to-air missile. 144 excellent eyewitnesses by July 30th, 2 weeks after the crash. And then the CIA guy explains how he tried to talk the FBI out of this, out of holding this position. And he said they're just about ready to release their preliminary report. It's never released. At this point, someone intervenes because that FBI report's never released. The next thing we hear from the FBI is August 17th, their first discussion with the New York Times about the eyewitnesses. Now, remember, on July 30th, we had 144 excellent eyewitnesses. By August 17th, the FBI is telling the New York Times there's only a handful of credible eyewitnesses. A handful. And the only one that they present to the FBI to talk to, the New York Times to talk to, is a fellow named Michael Russell, who's a serious guy. He's out on a trawler. He's an engineer. He, out of the corner of his eye, he looks up, and he sees a bright white flash off in the distance. And then he sees the plane fall right out of the sky. And they say that bright white flash is evidence of a high explosion, which means he saw a bomb. We believe it's a bomb. And then New York Times faithfully reports this further removes the possibility that a missile was responsible. That's the takeaway line.
Right.
The article they were given Russell, who wasn't lying or anything, it's just that he just saw it out of the corner of his eye. He didn't happen to catch the preceding, you know, smoke trail. And so then by August 17th, 1 month to the day after the crash, it's a bomb. We've decided it's going to be a bomb. The FBI can live with that bomb scenario for whatever reason. Maybe they figure it's the best we could do based on the pressure that's being put on us by the CIA. Now, they're not supposed to be collaborating at all. You know, this is the irony here. And then the bomb scenario holds for one more month. And it reaches a problematic state on August 23rd, because on that day, there is a headline above the fold right in the New York Times, and it says, prime evidence found that explosive device in cabin destroys TWA Flight 800. That's a paraphrase, but it's close. Above the fold left on that same day, Clinton signs welfare reform bill on eve of Democratic National Convention. One of those headlines has to go. And it's the one about the evidence found that bombs take out plane. Clinton is selling peace and prosperity to the nation. And if this plane's been destroyed by terrorists or whoever, the peace message is at risk. So that goes, and it takes him another month, I should say the day before that headline appears, knowing that headline is appearing, Jim Kallstrom, the head of the FBI investigation, is summoned for the first time to Washington. And who's calling him there? But none other than my favorite mistress of disaster, Jamie Gorelick, who's the Deputy Attorney General.
Oh, this is a beautiful story, folks.
And I had to set this up because Gorelick, Justice was Hillary's personal fiefdom, Department of Justice, and she insisted on having a female head of the Justice Department. And Joe is probably maybe too young to remember this happening, but we went through several alternates because they all had nanny problems and they got disqualified. Finally, they settled on Janet Reno, who's this feckless...
I remember.
You know, cranky old Miami prosecutor. And they make her attorney general, but they don't trust her, the Clintons don't, because she's halfway honest. So they have to circumvent her. And they put their own people in the number two slots. First, they have Webb Hubbell in there, and he ends up going to prison, so he's no good. And then they settle on Jamie Gorelick, who's a sort of a quiet, behind-the-scenes litigator from D.C. And Jamie Gorelick's their person. She's their henchwoman. She'll take care of him there. Now, I'm going to digress just a second to tell Jamie Gorelick's career arc after she takes over the investigation. And it's remarkable that this hasn't been reported in the major media, but...
I had to double-check your facts. Yeah. I did, because when I read this, I thought, nah...
It couldn't happen.
It doesn't sound right.
Right, it doesn't.
Not that I doubted you, but I did
double-check. Well, Jamie Gorelick, she does a very steely performance orchestrating the TWA 800 cover-up. You know, overseeing the collaboration between the CIA and the FBI. And then in May 1997, when this is pretty much safely put to bed, she gets a new job. It is the plum job in Washington. Now, she has no experience in finance and no experience in real estate, but she is made a vice chairman of Fannie Mae, among the most corrupt, self-serving operations in D.C. And over the next 6 years, Jamie Gorelick will self-serve herself to the tune of the queenly sum of $25 million. She makes $25 million in this quasi-public job for which she has no experience.
Right.
Then, in an act of either great patriotism or the need to CYA, you know, or CHA in her case, she takes one of five Democratic positions on the 9/11 commission, right? Now, when she's sitting there, when George Tenet brings up the issue of the wall, and she looks like, well, what wall? What's he talking about? And she's, oh, yeah, we knew about the wall. She said, I brought brutal force to try to break down that wall. And Tenet says, there were ironclad regulations. That wall was impenetrable. Well, 2 weeks later, John Ashcroft is testifying before the 9/11 commission. And he talks about, and they ask him, why did 9/11 happen? What was the obstacle? And he said, the single greatest obstacle was the wall. We weren't allowed to collaborate. The FBI and the CIA weren't allowed to cooperate. And then he says, I have to tell you this, though, and it's odd that I'm the one who brings it to you, but the author of the wall memorandum is sitting on the 9/11 commission. It's Jamie Gorelick.
Wow.
Yeah. Folks, you understand that? I mean,
that's a fact I did not know.
Yeah.
And the terrible irony of this is the same wall that prevented the CIA and the FBI from cooperating to prevent 9/11 was easily breached to subvert the TWA Flight 800 investigation, which, and this is what's new in this book, and no one, I mean, even TWA people don't know this. We knew that the FBI took over the investigation illegally from the NTSB on day one, but what no one knew is that the CIA took over the investigation from the FBI on day one.
And that's a good point, because Title 49 of the U.S. Code says, gives the NTSB, which it was, the NTSB began, it was created back in, what, 67?
Yes, 67, right.
And then went fully private in 74, I think.
Right.
But they are the agency that should oversee all aviation and all transportation disasters.
Right, and they wanted it because an independent agency.
Right.
Yeah,
not exactly, because of... But yet, we've got the FBI, the CIA involved, and who knows who else. Military as well, perhaps, involved?
Yeah, well, they're involved in the... certainly in the... you know, in the investigation.
Well, yeah.
Because they retrieved the stuff from the field and so on.
So, okay, I guess my question would be, why? I mean, clearly, if they're claiming, if Clinton and others are claiming that this was if this was a mechanical failure, or at least a
result of a bombing.
Why the FBI? Why the CIA? Why did this happen?
Well, I'm going to quote Vernon Gross, who's I talk about in the book, and also wrote a blurb for the book. I just had to, I'm not sure I can read it in this light here, but and since I'm the oldest literate American, it doesn't wear glasses. Anyhow, he blurbs the book in the back. He was an NTSB board member.
Uh-huh.
And on the night of July 17th, 1996, I should say he was a former one. He wasn't active at the time. CNN called him in to give on-the-air commentary. He was there all night, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he said, I've never seen anything like this. He goes, the FBI was there immediately running this investigation. He said, this is against the law. Even if they can only, and he explained, he goes, the NTSB has to call in the FBI when there's an accident, when there's a crime.
Right.
And the NTSB determines that. He said, in this case, they came in bully boy style. They took over immediately. He said he had never seen anything like that. And Gross is a high-level guy and, you know, all the right credentials. He went from being a believer in the government theory now to a total opponent of it. He said this is the best account he's ever seen of the crash. And there's other high-level people like that who turn once they saw the evidence. And more will turn once they have the green light to do so. And Doug, you're right. There's people who are watching the show have the power of as a mass to push this story up in the bottom.
And that's what it really makes me hopeful and very excited, because I really believe through audience participation, and it's going to take every one of us, mm-hmm. to, you know, we always talk about what can we do? I mean, things are so bad, you know, what can we do? We're powerless. No. We have the power. We can create or prompt changes. So it's going to take all of us to push the book up to number one, create a stir about what's in this book, obviously. And to do that, you know, you get to get the book. But, tell family, tell friends, make sure Jack Cashel, who, again, I believe is the foremost authority on TWA 800, the events, if you read the book, you'll see. We need to, I mean, he needs to tell his story everywhere, because at the
end... There's no statute of limitations on murder, absolutely. Especially the murder of 230 people.
Yeah. I mean, think if it was your mom or dad or child or brother or sister, my goodness, it would be devastating.
Yeah, and you don't know, answer.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm in touch with a lot of the families, and they are beside themselves. They have, you know, the word closure is overused, but
right.
They would certainly like that, you know?
Well, okay, getting back to the NTSB and CIA and FBI, Jim Hall was the NTSB
chairman
at the time, right? Did he roll over and just give up his investigation?
No, Hall didn't have to roll over because he came to the job pre-rolled. He was a Gore crony from Tennessee. In fact, when he was named chairman of the NTSB, the Washington Post said this snidely, they said, he's a middle-aged white man whose best credential for the job seems to be his driver's license. You know, no talent. He replaced a guy who was a physicist and pilot. You know, and astrophysicist or something. You know, from Princeton.
Yep.
So they quickly, with the Clintons, they corrupted every board they could with their cronies, just like they did the Fannie Mae board. You know, so they had no trouble pushing Jamie Gorelick through there. You know, so. When he takes over, and then they have the number two guy at the NTSB, is really the Clinton guy. Jim Hall is a pliable Gore crony. The number two guy, Robert Francis, was the Clinton guy, and even the people who wrote favorably about him said he reported directly to the Clintons. It's their number two people virtually in every department, you know?
Well, and that's the pattern.
Like Sandy Berger, deputy NSA guy, you know?
And again, I remember, I don't know why I remember these weird things, but I remember the Sandy Berger when he went into the National Archives and was removing documents. And, you know, I was thinking at the time, what documents would he be after? But you touch on this as well, very, very well in your book and, you know, what's, since we're getting close to the top of the hour here, you want to touch on the document removal, or you want to continue elsewhere?
Just talk about it, introduce Sandy Berger to the discussion. Yeah, we'll come back to him later on. He was the deputy national security advisor. He was the political guy.
Right.
So when the subject turned to politics, Tony Lake, who was the national security advisor, would admit, I left the room. But Sandy was the deputy. I talked to Colonel Buzz Patterson. Was really a great guy, and he carried a nuclear football for the president, mm-hmm. if you recall. And he's written a book or two about this subject. And that night, I said, "Where were you on the night of July 17th, 1996? He said, "I was in the White House, you know." And I said, "But I was kept out of the loop. You know, usually I'm involved in, you know, bringing information here and there, whatever, because he had obviously the top security classification." And then I said, "Where were the Clintons?" He said they were in the family quarters, in the residence. They weren't down in the Situation Room with everyone else. And I said, "Who was there with them?" He said, "You know, the only person I could identify," and he was a little tentative about this, but I'm almost sure, he goes, "is Sandy Berger." And now, so when 8 years later, Sandy Berger shows up in the National Archives, don't think that's not connected to TWA Flight 800, because it was.
Yeah, it's a very interesting connection that you make with respect to Sandy Berger. And it's even more interesting, the fact that the Clintons remained in the residence and they didn't go down to the Situation Room. Obviously. I mean, you know, or Bill Clinton anyway, didn't go down in the Situation Room.
Oh, neither did Hillary. They were together. Oh. I know, I have from her logs, I know they were there together.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. And obviously, that's...
Who's going to answer that 3 a.m. phone call?
Well, that's... Well, it's interesting you raise that, because in one of the Orthodox government rehash CNN books, it is at 3 a.m. that Bill Clinton calls down to Tony Lake, who's not in the White House, and situated family room, and says, dust off those contingency plans, which means that they're going to set in motion a scheme to distract the public from what really happened. And that is, for 2 weeks, they're going to blame Iran for this. But it's at 3 a.m. And then Hillary does those 3 a.m. commercials on Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Well, you know, I don't want to give away anything necessarily, put things out of order, because, but I mean, this is a huge story. We were very close to war, weren't we?
Well, we were faking war.
Okay.
For a while, yes. And in fact, Richard Clark, and he deserved his own petard to be hoisted on. Describes this chapter of the book, The Almost War of 1996, you know.
Yeah, he was a counterterrorism expert.
That's right, czar.
As well, he had a degree from MIT.
He went to UP, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He went to where?
University of Pennsylvania for his bachelor, okay. And then the MIT for his master's.
He wrote Against All Enemies, too, yeah. Folks.
And he plays a role in his book that's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, indeed. And, of course, he worked for the State Department during Reagan's presidency in 1992. Bush appointed him to the chair of the Counterterrorism Security Group. And, he had a seat on the National Security Council. But, very interesting indeed. All right, as we run up to... You know what I'm missing because of our...
the clock?
Doesn't it seem a little strange here?
Yeah, usually the clock's, you know...
We can see this. Face. Yeah. We've got about 3 minutes left at the top of the hour. What... in this 3 minutes here... I mean, again, you make a great case in this book, but to cap off the next 3 minutes here, give us a tidbit here where... the next hour is going to take us, because, folks, you got to stay tuned for this.
Well, let's talk about Richard Clark for just a second.
Okay.
And then talk about the way the media work. What's fascinating is this is the Almost War of 1996.
Yeah.
And yet, when Bill Clinton writes his memoirs, the number one news story in 1996, the Almost War of 1996, his 900-page book, one paragraph, right?
That's right.
Hillary Clinton, her memoir, Is It My Life or whatever, her 500-page book, she goes to meet with the families and at JFK and hugs them and whatnot. One-third of one sentence.
That's right.
George Stephanopoulos, in his memoir, he's in the Situation Room that night. Nothing. George Tenet, in his memoir, he's the assistant director of Central Intelligence. He's the guy who's running this whole scam. Nothing. Leon Panetta, who's the one who calls Clinton with the news that the plane went down? Nothing. Dick Morris refers to it as one of three terrorist attacks that summer.
Yep.
Beyond that, nothing in their memoirs. It's a black hole. It falls right through the cracks. Or the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, 1996-97. The CIA is deeply involved. Everything the CIA does is in that committee yearbook. Nothing. This story is not being told except in 2004 when Richard Clark comes forward to tell his version. Maybe we could pick that up after the
Good. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Pick that up on the other side.
This is amazing, Joe. I mean, Hillary Clinton, 528 pages, her book, Living History, the memoir, one-third of a sentence. Yeah. When I read that, and I did have to check, we've got a copy in our library, and you're right, I can't remember what page it was on, but
right, Louis Free, sentences.
Yeah, yeah.
Head of the FBI, the biggest FBI job during his tenure.
Yeah,
two sentences.
Two sentences.
Indecisive sentences. We didn't know what it was. Blah blah blah. You know,
that's amazing. All those people leaving out key details and information, even their own insights as to what happened on that day, to me, speaks more of guilt than of anything else.
Right, and it's also sort of preparing the way for Loretta Lynch to redact the obvious from.
We're talking with Jack Cashel in studio. His book, TWA 800. We'll be right back with Mr. Cashel after these short messages. Stay with us on this Tuesday edition of the Hagman & Hagman Report.
The crash, the cover-up, and the conspiracy.
This is the Global Star Radio Network.